And I say this fully aware that I am an online alternative media influencer. I'm one of the mutated media entities that this environment has birthed, okay? I'm fully aware of that.
I think that anyone who is seriously, or any government officials that are seriously considering VPN bans, should look at who is banning VPNs today, because it's, you know, primarily some of the world's worst human rights offenders, but ask themselves if that's really a list that they want to be added to.
Hello, hello. I'm joined by Sarah McLaughlin, who is a senior scholar of global expression at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on a chat. We are talking about, I think, free speech absolutism and then stuff related to freedom of speech today in the United States.
There's nothing going on there.
Nothing going on there. What can you talk to me more specifically, I guess, on stuff that you've been looking at, I guess, over the past 6 months? What is like your specific area of interest on things?
Yeah, so I've been spending about the past year, back in August, I had a book come out that examined the relationship between higher education, especially in the U.S., but globally, and authoritarian states like China. And this is kind of the broader topic that I'm really interested in, the way that freer countries and authoritarian countries kind of overlap and push and pull with each other when it comes to free speech. But in the past 6 months, you know, I've just been writing a lot about what's been going on with free speech globally. Obviously, right now, a lot of that is related to internet speech. A lot of it's related to Israel and Palestine. So those have been kind of the really strong points, the big issues that I've been looking at. But, you know, I think what's interesting is that I write about both the U.S. and global speech issues, and we're all kind of dealing with the same things to a certain extent. You can boil things down to some fundamental questions about free expression that everyone is dealing with in the U.S. or not.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how opinionated you want to get on this. I guess, I don't know how much you know in terms of what I do or my background or anything, but I'm like online politics for the past 10 years. I've done a lot of, I would say, like debate style content, argued with a lot of different people. I would like to think I do a fair bit I just watched Cuomo arguing with Bill O'Reilly, so my brain is still completely scrambled from the insanity of that conversation. I'm trying to emotionally and psychologically recover from how horrendous that conversation was. So bear with me. Sorry. Okay. One of the frustrations that I've noticed in all the political conversations over the past kind of like 10 years is the information environment online has become severely degraded, such that I don't know how like a normal human being who has an ordinary job is supposed to navigate that environment and understand what's real, what's not real, who's trustworthy. Just everything is just like so crazy today. And obviously people hit this from a freedom of speech perspective and that, you know, we should clamp down on a lot. And then other people obviously kind of with the, well, who decides on how to clamp down? What are your general feelings on what to do about like the massive amount of misinformation, disinformation, both domestic and foreign, that exists today on people's internets?
So I think, you know, one of the frustrations people have with the free speech perspective, which is one I share, is that I think they often feel like free speech advocates don't significantly grapple with the fact that, you know, lies can do a lot of damage. You know, false information actually can have a real big impact on society. I mean, we're watching measles cases go up in the U.S., right? And, you know, to what extent is people reading and engaging with, you know, bad ideas about health leading to that? So, you know, it is important that we, you know, engage with that and discuss it. But I think that there are different solutions that we can look at for state action. When it comes to addressing lies, misinformation, things like that on the internet. And the reason why is that, you know, I've been watching how countries have been responding to what they call misinformation or fake news on the internet in the past 5 years, for example. And I cannot tell you how much of it I have seen has been focusing on people who criticize the government over how they deal with pandemics, with natural disasters. You know, there was a really terrible fire recently in Hong Kong that led to a lot of people dying. you know, the government was targeting people for what they claimed was false information about building code safety. During COVID-19 pandemic, we had governments that were targeting people for fake news, for saying that the government wasn't doing enough to protect people against the pandemic. So, you know, this is, I realize, you know, it's not always the most satisfying answer, but this is one of those cases where giving government the power to determine truth and falsity is really dangerous. And I'm really interested in alternative solutions that are more community-based. You know, obviously on X, there's not always working perfectly, but, you know, using some kind of community notes function or some kind of way for people to participate in fact-checking, you know, statements on the internet that makes them feel like there isn't some authority that's saying, like, we know everything and we're going to tell you everything that's true or wrong. When people feel like they can trust that there's some kind of community aspect, you know, Taiwan has been looking at really interesting ways to counter misinformation from China, for example. And so I think there are ways that we can approach it that don't actually create worse outcomes for public trust, because I don't think having some central authority that enforces censorship actually even fixes the trust issue in the first place.
Okay. Have you ever seen the movie Sunshine?
Sunshine.
It starts off as a sci-fi and it becomes like a horror movie.
I think I'm vaguely familiar with it, but not enough to engage.
That's fine. There's a line I just love so much in this film, and it's the only time I've ever seen it. There's always like a moment in a movie, and they have it in this movie, where they're thinking about like diverting their mission to do a thing or to continue on the mission, and somebody says like, okay, well, let's take a vote. And then one of the, I think the science officer of the ship is like, no, we're not voting on this. We are a group of highly trained, intelligent people, officers. You know, we're going to make the best decision. Does everything need to have a community sign-off on stuff? So one of the things I'm looking at when it comes to information right now that exists in our landscape is, and I say this fully aware that I am an online alternative media influencer. I'm one of the mutated media entities that this environment has birthed. Okay. I'm fully aware of that. But like maybe like gatekeeping some stuff was okay or was good. Maybe it was better when trained doctors were having conversations about medications, or journalists that were on the ground were having conversations about what was going on in other countries. Do you see any form of like gatekeeping function coming back that would be positive for the media environment? Or I guess, what are solutions that you look at that can control the massive stem of just total insanity that is flooding every platform right now?
Well, you know, I think that's, you know, something that is a great idea for innovation. Like, how can we innovate new ways to get experts to people that can have people access experts, their knowledge, their ideas, and in a way that makes them feel, you know, welcome, that they feel like they are not engaging in some kind of closed off, censored conversation. Because I really do think it is never going to work for public trust if we have people feel like there is some kind of government authority that is setting the rules for what can be said. And, you know, if we look a few months ago at Alex Preddy's death, right? If we had listened to the government line about what happened there, we would all be under the impression that he was conducting a violent attack, right, on you know, DHS agents. But only because we had people who were, you know, citizens who were challenging the government narrative, that was the only way we actually could get some, you know, sense of truth about what happened in that moment. So I'm always wary of, you know, creating situations where there is some kind of government gatekeeper. If we can come up with new innovative ideas where we can have, you know, people opt into systems where, you know, maybe you opt into something where you have a medical fact checker who's saying like, hey, you know, I'm an expert you trust. I'm going to tell you what's true and what's false about this. I love ideas like that. I just think we need to find ways to do it that encourage public trust and don't give government power to set the standards for truth.
Gotcha. And then I don't know how much you want to push into specifics on this, because I can get very, very in the weeds on this, because this is like a central issue in my mind right now for the world political landscape, but especially in the United States. How do you deal with the fact that, I guess on this, like, I don't know if an average person is equipped to navigate certain environments to even begin to make the choice of what's a better or what's a worse thing for me. And it seemed like in the past, these things were kind of gatekept a little bit more because everything wasn't open to infinite skepticism. And now that everybody can be a skeptic of everything, people are able to kind of like shop around for ideas or things more that, you know, feel better to them. And then especially as consequences are harder to see or they're more removed from the actions that people are taking, it seems easier and easier for people to be kind of like misled into like another world where I don't even know if there's any kind of natural corrective mechanism for the things that'll happen. So to ground this out in an example, I don't know what you sound on this, so sorry if this is going to be a super politically divisive one between the two of us, but there was a huge push for ivermectin as being like a cure-all now for everything, but especially back in the days for COVID. It never was. This never panned out. No research, nothing. That was absolutely not true. But there are people that would specifically request doctors that would prescribe them ivermectin. And the vast majority of these people that were prescribed ivermectin got better because most people that get sick get better. And now you've got a lot of people who are like, well, you know, I was sick, I got ivermectin, and I got better. And I think this was actually a good idea. How do you, like, where there's not like that mechanism of like, you made a bad decision and then here's like the results and now you're correct, like how do we get people back into the world of like making good decisions and being able to choose good people to get information from? Because right now I only see us trending in the total wrong direction is how I feel we've gone for like the past decade.
Yeah, so a couple thoughts there. The first is that, yeah, I do think there is definitely a certain degree of ease now with, you know, choose your own adventure when it comes to truth. It's very easy to specifically, you know, fill your inbox and your social media feeds with people who are going to tell you exactly what you want to hear and tell you, you know, whatever theories that may be completely false that you believe are the truth, and you are so smart for knowing better than everyone else.
Forbidden knowledge.
That is a reality. But the second part of that is that I don't think that we will get very far with people by suggesting to them. I think they're going to feel condescended to if we, you know, don't. If we need to find a way to engage with people that won't, that isn't, you know, you're too stupid to know the truth when you see it, right? So I think we need to find ways to engage with people where they don't feel like they're being condescended to. And, you know, I think there's also the, you know, the second step there of humility, where we need to all understand, me, I've been wrong about things, and it's very painful because I love being right. But we also need to realize that we're going to be wrong about things too, and we might have the absolute certainty that the people we're speaking to are wrong and they look like total fools on the internet. And it turns out we were wrong. I mean, we, you know, early stages of COVID, there was a lot of information that absolutely seemed to be true, like, you know, this isn't airborne, you don't need masks, and it turned out probably should be wearing a mask. Sometimes we're wrong, and I do think it's good if we approach this, you know, discussion about gatekeeping, about truth, with just a certain amount of humility too, because I don't think we'll do a good job of convincing people, you know, to look at what we believe or know to be the truth if we think, you know, if they think that we don't have any degree of humility about it, and that we're too certain, if that makes sense.
Okay, so here's a problem that I have related to this, what you're saying here is the selective skepticism or the selective, I guess, humility. So I would agree that science gets stuff wrong sometimes. I mean, I think it was The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine that published the huge, you know, vaccines causes autism study. I say huge, it was like 20 people or whatever, you know, so long ago. So, I mean, like, obviously scientific journals can get things wrong, institutions can get things wrong, but like generally speaking, I would say they move in the right direction, and then they acknowledge errors, or they'll, you know, do retractions, or they'll say, hey, we were wrong on this. And people will say things like, well, they've lost our trust now because they were wrong on this thing and they've lost our trust. But then when I look at the other side, and now I look at the people they are trusting, those people are wrong like 95% of the time. Why don't they ever lose the trust of the people? Like, what? How is it that Alex Jones can get up and say, you know, most of the conspiracies were correct? I was like, no, almost all of them were wrong. But then for some reason, they still trust him. You know, like, I got my series of shots, and I got, I think two different COVID boosters, and I'm still waiting to drop dead or my heart to explode. It hasn't happened yet. Supposedly, there was going to be like a mass death event, mass casualty event in the United States from all the COVID shots.
It hasn't hit me yet either.
Yeah. So. But how is it that, like, it seems like the loss of credibility only hits one side. People are looking at Fauci like, well, he was wrong about masks this one time, and so now we can't trust the NIH anymore. Meanwhile, these other guys are wrong about almost everything, and people are like, well, you know, he told me this, so I'm going to do this now. And it's like, why? There seems to be a dramatic imbalance there, and I don't know how to address that thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a perfect answer for that either. I think it's possible, and you know, this is just a little bit of guesswork here. It's possible that people look to figures that they perceive to be authority with certain expectations, and then they have different expectations for people they don't perceive as figures of authority or institutions. Maybe that's not true. Maybe it is. But you know, ultimately, I think we're having two separate conversations here, which is one, what is the appropriate recourse for bad ideas legally, and then two, what's the appropriate recourse socially? Mm-hmm. And I have certainly better answers for the first one. But the second one, it's one we're going to have to, I think, experiment with. You know, I'm occasionally a technology skeptic, but I'm hopeful that, you know, we'll keep finding ways to use technology to find solutions for some of the problems we have. I think, you know, we have to, there's no other alternative, so we have to try, right?
Sure. So the legal argument, I guess, is interesting to me. You mentioned before that most of the government stuff related to freedom of speech ended up being speech against the government. I feel like, I guess, intuitively, that kind of makes sense to me, though, because I feel like if somebody were to go on the internet and just say that, like, oh, Stephen Bonnell murdered 20 babies, well, like, that's an actionable thing that I can sue for defamation for. So, like, I don't technically need the government to protect me from that kind of lie, because there's civil litigation that's open to me. Whereas if somebody wants to come out and spread broadly, like, oh, measles and chickenpox are the same thing, and it's actually not really dangerous at all, well, who even has standing to bring a suit there? So it makes sense that, like, most of the government actions that would be taken against stuff online is going to be stuff that probably contradicts stuff that's within the purview of the government, I guess. But then obviously, I mean, that can be problematic for a whole host of reasons. You know, you identify the ICE agent and everything. What, I guess, what do you think are acceptable steps for any kind of government body to take when it comes to free speech related stuff?
Yeah, so so obviously, you know, when it comes to the First Amendment, at least in the United States, we're talking about a very narrow range of circumstances that the government, you know, that censorship or retaliation against speech is appropriate. So we're talking about things like true threats, incitement, and those all have really specific, you know, concepts and definitions. And I know a lot of people think, like, you say the word kill, that automatically means a true threat. And like, no, that's actually a really specific concept that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, outside of that, I want to see the government using more speech. I want to see them using the appropriate measures. You know, their government officials have the ability to respond to false information, right? If, you know, they can say measles and the chickenpox or like measles and cancer aren't the same thing. They have the ability to go and, you know, as public health officials, issue guidance, issue statements. So, you know, I don't personally trust a lot of public health officials to necessarily have the authority to determine what is truth and false about medical issues, for example. You know, using the power of the state, I can't imagine the things that they would have been saying 100 years ago about women's health, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'm very comfortable with the government staying within its very specific bounds of power to issue more speech. But outside of that, I don't want to see them trying to censor.
What do you think? Can you think of any systems, I guess, in place right now that have gotten things right, or like a thing that you see that's kind of like promising that's moving in the right direction?
When it comes to government speech, like government, like, actors responding to things, or
like correcting, I guess, what you would consider to be, or I guess maybe actually we'll take a step back more broadly. Have you identified any big problems you think with like the speech environment that exists today in the Western world, where you're like, oof, this is like really bad stuff. We need to find a way to deal with it. Not necessarily through government censorship, but just like you've identified, like, this is an area of like bad stuff, like bad speech, I think.
That the government is responding well to it.
Or I guess, well, first, like, do you think there is like bad speech out there? Or do you think that everything is kind of like fair game? Yeah.
No. Anyone who, you know, any free speech advocate that doesn't, you know, concede that there's very bad speech is not doing a very good job, I think. Mm-hmm. No, there's a lot of, you know, really terrible speech. There's hateful speech. There's lying. There's I think there's a lot of ways that speech can be used for ill. And the, I think for a lot of people, that's the, the grand reason why we have to censor. And I think that's also the flip side of that is why I'm really uncomfortable with censorship. Speech is powerful. And I think the reason why I want to protect speech rights is because I do think it's really powerful and it actually has power for good, not just ill. When it comes to, right now governments using their power to respond, there's always, international collaborations that are going on to try to combat hatred. And when they're done in a way that doesn't censor speech, I think that's great. I think we need to be using, finding ways to collaborate, within the US government and among governments around the world to respond to things in a way that promotes free speech and promotes the values we want to see rather than hatred or lies. There's always good efforts, I think, going on to educate people about health, public health especially. On the whole, I would not say there's many good things happening right now when it comes to the, question of free speech globally.
Gotcha. And then more specifically, I guess, what are some, can you think of any good initiatives right now that I guess individual companies or governments or anybody, is taking that you view as being a positive step in the right direction?
That's an interesting question. I think there's, a lot of efforts right now to encourage people to be using technology in a way that suits them, in a way that advances their lives and that assists them. But whether that's necessarily government run, I wouldn't say. I think that's probably more in the bounds of private actors, but yeah.
Okay. Well, what else? I don't know how deep you want to get into any particular thing. Do you have strong opinions on, I think in Europe now, or actually more specifically, how do you feel about children on social media? That's a hot topic, I guess, right now.
Yes, that is a really big topic right now. And it's one that I've been, I just wrote a piece today actually about the UK's under 16 ban. Mm-hmm. This is, we are kind of at a global fever pitch right now when it comes to specifically under 16 bans. I have a lot of issues with the way that this is being, conducted. Mm-hmm. It's not because I don't think that there aren't concerns about kids being online. Listen, I'm a woman in my 30s and I see things I don't want to see on the internet. So
yeah.
I understand the issues of having a 14-year-old. Surfing social media without, any restriction. I understand why people are fearful of that. But we always have a noble reason, right, to crack down on speech or technology. Somebody can always give you a good reason why that speech has to be curtailed. But that doesn't mean it's a good enough reason to institute new policies and new restrictions that I think are mass scale violations of people's rights. And that's what's going on with under 16 bans. So basically, all of these laws that are popping up globally go back to Australia's under 16 ban, which was kind of like the landmark policy that came out. But the problem is it isn't actually working. There's been this kind of trade-off that I think we were expected to agree to. There's some privacy risks and censorship risks that come from this. But it actually isn't working. From the government's own data, 7 out of 10 kids who had social media accounts before the ban still have those accounts. So kids are finding workarounds anyway. They're still, accessing social media, and it hasn't changed that much on that front. But it is creating really severe privacy risks for adults. I think we've kind of allowed this misnomer about under 16 bans to go too far because it isn't just about 15-year-olds. It requires people to verify their age and, depending on the tools that are used, perhaps identity. Then there's a second issue of VPNs. VPNs allow people to flout these age restrictions. So naturally, countries that are pursuing these restrictions are going to have to face the question, okay, are we going to crack down on VPNs to enforce these rules? And the UK is suggesting they are. They said they're going to release new guidance next month about how they're going to handle VPN access. I really think that it is just creating this huge growing mess that's rolling downhill and taking more rights with it as it goes. And there's a lot of questions. We don't actually have a full picture of how social media and internet use affects young people. You know, it's being treated as some kind of settled conversation when I don't think it is. And we also haven't really done much discussion about what this means for people who, A, are over 16 and have to verify their age, and also parents who maybe want to have control over what their kids do online and not, you know, hand that power necessarily straight to government.
Do you think that people should have a right to use a VPN? If I were to liken this to, say, should I have a right to send mail from my house and put an inaccurate, like, return address? What do you think is the strongest version if somebody wanted to attack the concept of a VPN and say, well, if you're accessing a website, you should ultimately know who's accessing said website, or at least, like, you know, that IP address should geolocate to a particular residence rather than being blackholed somewhere in, you know, Russia or whatever.
Well, and, you know, there are countries that do ban VPNs, and they do explain their legal reasoning, and it's because they're used to conduct illegal acts. And, you know, those illegal acts are perhaps accessing gay propaganda in Russia, accessing illegal political material in China, things like that. So, you know, countries do ban it on the basis that it is a conduit to illegal action. So, you know, that is something that countries do ban. Mm-hmm. I think that anyone who is seriously, or any government officials that are seriously considering VPN bans, should look at, you know, who is banning VPNs today, the reasons why they do so, and ask themselves if that's really a list that they want to be added to, because it's, you know, primarily some of the world's worst human rights offenders. And, you know, ask some basic follow-up questions about, you know, what do we think this technology, are we doing the right thing by banning this technology? And I think anyone who's looking at clear-eyed will see that they're not.
Can I ask, so just pushing on this a little bit, what is, like, a conceivable positive use, I guess, for a VPN that we think should be, like, a valuable thing to protect for an ordinary citizen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it allows people, I mean, even people in the U.S. Might be wanting to use VPNs. We have, you know, we've been discussing this kind of as a European issue and an Australian issue. We're having state by state things pop up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there might be some people who feel like they really want to access information about abortion in a certain state. Maybe they should be using a VPN. Maybe if you want to look at, you know, information about certain LGBT issues, you should be using a VPN just to be safe. So, you know, giving people that feeling like they are not going to be bound by, you know, repressive perhaps rules that they shouldn't be operating under in the first place. You know, that's really important. And that's what people use it for many times around the world. I mean, people who, you know, if you're in a country that has really strict laws about information about women's health, you know, these are vital tools for people to access information their government's banning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people will always be able to come up with some horrible example of the terrible things on the internet. Yeah, you, of course you can. There's terrible things online. But, you know, to try to cut VPN access just because there's bad things would be so damaging to so many people.
Gotcha. What are other types of, so I know that the under 16 bans are a really big issue everywhere. Obviously, in the United States, for whatever reason, we lost the, I guess the age gating porn thing was lost at the Supreme Court level. So now I don't even know how many states in the US, 15 or 20, now have, like, ID requirements to access adult material online, depending on the website. What are other big fights that you kind of see on the horizon or that are already here when it comes to, like, big legislative actions relating to internet stuff or freedom of speech?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously age verification more broadly is just going to be a fight we're going to be having in the future. Mm-hmm. And it, there's some people who are, you know, say, that's not a big deal. I'm not worried about it. You know, it's an overreaction to suggest that because you have to verify your age, the government is going to have access to every website you visit and all everything you do on the internet. But I think people are being a little too... they're not being cautious enough on that front because, you know, some of these things sure are going to go through third parties, but they'll be hacked. Like Discord, for example, they recently got hacked. So, you know, the idea that this information, just because it's not accessed by the government or not necessarily accessed by the government is not going to be available to anyone is not true. So that's absolutely one of the things that we're going to be fighting. And then, you know, more broadly, national security stuff is, again, just kind of like a global issue when it comes to people wanting to censor speech. You know, not just on the internet, but for example, we had Brendan Carr here in the U.S., you know, threatening government action over the way people were talking about the war with Iran. These are, you know, that's the kind of thing that you'd expect to see, not in the United States, frankly. So I don't love to see, or I'm pretty alarmed to see that some of the national security justifications for censorship that I see in repressive countries are popping up in the U.S. too.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, do you know anything about South Korean internet?
I can't say that I do. It's not something I've really looked into very much.
I only bring this up. This just popped in my mind. I'm surprised nobody's ever talked about this before, or maybe they have somewhere. My background on the internet, I used to be a professional StarCraft player a lifetime ago. But I want to say in South Korea, I think that I think when you bought game keys, I think they were tied to like your Korean social security number, because if you were mm-hmm. a child, you weren't allowed to either play late at night or on weekends or something. So they had like an auto curfew set up. So getting a South Korean StarCraft account was really difficult because they were tied to like your social security numbers. I wonder how that ever turned out, or if anybody ever followed data on that. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that the UK is doing too. So, you know, as I mentioned, it's an under 16 ban, but they're also going to have internet curfews for 16 and 17 year olds. That's the plan. So, to limit how much time they can be, using social media at night, even as, you know, 17 year old, not quite the same, but you know, it's, similar vein.
Yeah. Do you think that there are some issues that Republicans and Democrats in the United States are aligned on when it comes to internet privacy related stuff or free speech stuff that you think, or that you would want to see people jointly push legislative actions on, you know, next legislative session? Or
actually one thing that we're you know, really hopeful about is a bill we have against, or a bill that is out right now against jawboning. It's called the Jawbone Act, and it's co-sponsored by Ted Cruz and Ron Wyden, and that's kind of what we want to see, right? We want to see across the aisle you know, advocacy for the idea that the government, whether it's Brendan Carr trying to threaten Jimmy Kimmel, or, you know, a future Democratic president, whoever it might be, trying to use government power to coerce private actors to censor speech. We want to see bipartisan action against that. You know, that's really the only way that these things can succeed, is if we get across the board coalitions to say, no, we're not going to allow this. Because if you only have, you know, one political party advocating for kind of, you know, protections against censorship, sometimes people see it as partisan when it really shouldn't be. So that's something I'm hopeful about and, you know, really hope to see.
And then I guess for the people that are worried about like child safety online or really bad material online, what's the thing you say to them when they're looking for, because they might feel like they don't have the options in the real world to enforce anything with their children or to protect people from these types of materials online? What do you say to kind of appease them, you know, when they're like, what is there any kind of regulation or bone that you can throw at those people, or they're trying to find ways to solve these problems? Yeah. How do you address their concerns?
Yeah, so there are, you know, tools and technologies and apps that parents can put on their kids' phones to limit what their kids can do. And I understand that that's not going to solve everything. Your kid can go use another kid's phone. You know, your kid can probably access a different laptop where you can't necessarily control everything that happens on it. But that's, there are some fundamental basics about the world that are out of our control, or that are out of people's control as parents. But I do wish we were doing a better job to empower parents to, you know, understand what tools they actually already can use, without just assuming that there's some kind of government solution for everyone. And the other thing I would say is to, you know, encourage parents to, you know, advocate for their own rights and authorities here, because different parents are going to want to limit different things for their kids. You're going to want to have some parents that only want their kid to see, you know, Christian material, things that, you know, support a really specific religious worldview. And then you're going to have other parents that want their kid to be able to access information about LGBT issues. And I think both of those parents should be able to conduct things the way they want to, should be able to raise the kid the way they want to. And so I actually think it's kind of empowering to parents to say, you know, you're allowed to, you know, inspire in your kid the kind of speech and values you want to see them embrace. So, instead of just kind of relying on, a government response that might not even work the way they promise it will, like it did in Australia, and like it probably won't in the UK, you can actually take some power there. I was raised by parents who had really strict rules. I'm not a gamer because I wasn't allowed to touch video games, so I just never really got into it. Mm-hmm. But other kids want to, or other parents want to play video games with their kids. And like, those are decisions you can make on your own as a parent. And I think, people should be able to do that. If you want to play StarCraft with your kid at 10 p.m., you should probably be able to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any other major things you can think of, or issues or topics? Or
one that I've gotten obviously a lot of questions about has been speech about Israel-Palestine. Mm-hmm. That has been another issue that's hit the U.S. And that's hit a lot of European countries. And I think, not to focus too much on the U.K., but I think that's been an especially worrying and fascinating issue in the U.K. More broadly, the UK has been conducting a lot of arrests, like thousands annually, investigations for people for speech that's just perceived as offensive on social media. But another thing that they've been doing is arresting people for holding signs, just peacefully holding signs that say, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action. And all of this is related to this group that was banned, the group called Palestine Action. Mm-hmm. And they were banned under anti-terror legislation because some members broke into, I believe, a Royal Air Force base and mm-hmm. spray painted planes, which is not protected, wouldn't be protected in the U.S., shouldn't be protected anywhere. That's vandalism. That's the kind of thing that governments can absolutely punish. But the thing that's been really worrying to me and disturbing to see is the way that people who just talk about Palestine Action and more broadly express support for the group's ideas, they're being arrested under that same anti-terror legislation. And it's really incredible. And I don't think it's a story that's gotten enough attention, because I think, people are so comfortable. Terrorism is one of those words that when you hear it, you say, okay, of course I want the government to act against terrorism. Like, who wouldn't want the government to punish terrorism? But when we have these super broad conceptions of terrorism, then you get people arrested and potentially facing years in prison for holding a sign peacefully. So that's been one of, I think, the more shocking news stories of the past year. But there's been a lot going on, so I could go on a lot of different directions if you want me to.
How do you did you have any strong questions, or did you follow kind of like the legislative and then the Supreme Court rationale behind the TikTok thing in the United States, like separating out ByteDance from TikTok in China, and whether or not they could operate as that like hybrid entity where you have like the Chinese algorithm, but then the U.S. facing company? Is anybody at Fire? Did you have a particular opinion on that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting one to watch. I have colleagues at Fire who are better versed on the exact, ruling and how that case settled out and how it's still panning out, because, there's still some unsettled things that resulted from that. But, mm-hmm. I was fascinated by it because I don't use TikTok. I won't use TikTok. I write a lot about censorship and the Chinese government, the way that the Chinese government exports its censorship to free countries. Mm-hmm. And I have some concerns about the TikTok app and the safety of using it. So I'm not on it. But I also had concerns about the way the U.S. conducted itself in banning it. And I think this is kind of one of those fascinating, messy questions, right? That comes from how does a free country handle the challenges posed by an unfree country? And to me, the answer is not doing things that take away that free country's rights. And so I was concerned about the way that, the government handled TikTok. More broadly, I've been concerned about the use of federal power in recent months and years. But I mean, that was bipartisan. Nobody wanted TikTok to be allowed to operate in the U.S. So that wasn't a one-party issue there. I've been concerned about the comfort the federal government has with attacking tools and speech and technology on the internet under a guise that I don't think passes First Amendment muster. Mm-hmm.
Do you, okay, this is going to be a very broad political question. I'll ask the broad one and then the specific one, I guess, because this is kind of like my concern as somebody that exists on the internet. So the first question is like, do you, I guess broadly, do you support kind of like the West, the global West? And then more specifically, do you think in the current media environment, do you think it is benefiting the West more or people who are oppositional to the West? Because in my, the take that I've kind of had, especially over, again, over the past decade, is that the information landscape on the internet has allowed like malicious actors and sometimes malicious foreign actors to thrive in so many protected ways that it feels like sometimes they're cloaking themselves in all of the freedoms that we have in the West. And then they're using that to attack so much that is foundational to the West that we end up getting into areas that are more antithetical to freedom of speech than we would have been initially. So like I would say, for instance, the rise of Trump and then the extreme amount of federal pressure that he's putting on liberal concepts of free speech today are so much more oppressive than if we would have like banned TikTok completely, you know, like, you know, 12 years ago or whatever. Yeah, I guess, do you have any thoughts, I guess, related to that?
Yeah. So I have a lot of thoughts there. So the first is, yeah, I mean, I'm grateful to live, you know, I think the concept of the West, you know, people like to debate and fight over it. But, mm-hmm. you know, more broadly, if the question is, do I prefer or am I grateful to live in a free democratic society? Yes. And I think that's, you know, it's very easy for me to look at it, you know, especially someone who sees how women are treated in non-free democratic societies. Yeah. This is the world that I would prefer to live in. But then, you know, to your second question about, you know, how we handle people who, you know, I guess, because they are taking advantage of freedoms of the West to pursue, you know, authoritarian or unfree causes. It's something that I've definitely had to grapple with. You know, one thing I wrote a lot about in my book was this student group. It's called Chinese and Student Scholars Associations. Mm-hmm. So it's CSSA. And they're at campuses all around the world. And, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with student groups for, you know, shared backgrounds. That's what a lot of student groups are. But these CSSA chapters, even on American campuses, have been using their campuses to try to censor critics of the Chinese government in a mm-hmm. lot of cases. So they'll write to their university leadership and they'll say, you know, this Uyghur speaker is actually hateful and hurtful to Chinese students. And the university has a duty to us as tuition paying students to disinvite this person, to not let them speak on campus. You know, there's a exiled political figure, Nathan Law from Hong Kong, who was a pro-democracy lawmaker before he was forced to leave Hong Kong. And he was supposed to come, he did come to the University of Chicago a few years ago, and the CSSA chapter there said that he was, you know, conducting hate speech. His speech wasn't protected by the First Amendment. It was wrong in a lot of ways. But it's an interesting question, right? How do we deal with people that are using the freedoms of a free country to advocate for the censorship and for you know, the silencing of dissidents? And it's a really messy thing. You know, the first step is that I think free countries have a responsibility just first not to fold to people who are making those demands or kind of trying to enforce that pressure. But the problem is sometimes there's financial incentive tied up with it to give in to that pressure, right? So you might have a large contingent of tuition paying students who say there's gonna be financial price to pay. And you know, we see this with actually some tech companies, some global industries, this idea that if you don't conform with some authoritarian governments' rules or demands, you're going to pay a financial price. Like we saw that with the NBA and Daryl Morey when he tweeted fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong. So these are things that free countries have to deal with. So first is don't give in to the censorship. But second is don't start censoring and chipping away at those rights just to deal with that issue. Because that's when you create a country that is less free than the one you started with. So it's, you know, a really complex, difficult thing. But we have to find ways to respond that address the issue, reject it, but don't cut away at the protections that actually protect the dissenters in the first place.
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. Anything else? I don't know how deep or wherever, if there's any other part of the conversation you want to visit or anything more particular or more broad or...
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to talk more about speeches in the US abroad. Any questions you have, I'll do my best to answer.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I guess the position that I kind of occupy right now is I used to come from a more free speech absolutist position, but I feel like there is a you can have like a fundamental value, right? So like freedom of speech is like a fundamental value, but it's not like if it doesn't achieve the end of free speech, then the value itself is like kind of worthless. So like the example I give is that like 10 people in a room screaming at each other might be enjoying the ultimate freedom of speech, but in reality, there's like no real speech happening there because nobody can hear what's going on. You know, everybody's just screaming. As opposed to like a more regulated environment might seem a little bit more anti-free speech, but there might be more actual conversation happening here as a result of the fact that people can actually hear each other. And one thing that I've found so difficult to balance over the past, I keep saying decade because I feel like in 2016 when Trump came in, things really started to kind of change, especially over the past like 5 or 6 years, like post-COVID, that every time I'm making free speech arguments, I find that like all of my, bedfellows, all my companions are just liars. And it is, and I don't see any way ever to like push back against them in a totally unregulated environment. It seems like the social media platforms have totally abdicated all of that. I feel like the community notes thing started off as an interesting idea, but they get brigaded so hard, they don't seem to affect any kind of positive end anymore. And then I see all of our institutions just constantly under assault by these people that are just the most malicious actors in the universe that never get any real pushback. And all the financial incentive seems to be there for them. All of the algorithmic pushing of their content seems to be there for them. And yeah, I'm trying to find some way to exist in that environment. And it feels like it feels like that freedom of speech environment right now is being hijacked in a way that I would argue we don't really enjoy the benefits of that freedom of speech at all because it's been abused by so many bad actors. So like I'll give to go back to COVID, like I can give another example. Like I think like in a perfect freedom of speech environment, I think it would be super fascinating to hear people debate about prospectively what we could have done related to lockdowns. I think that is a conversation it will never be fully explored publicly because instead of having people prospectively debating, like, should we have ever locked up kids? Like, should the lockdowns have been more targeted? Should there have been stronger federal oversight on them? Should they have just been targeted to certain age groups? Rather than that conversation, the only conversations we have publicly are how many billions of dollars did Fauci get paid to lock up people? Why did Cuomo send old people to die with COVID? Why were the Jews getting the vaccine first and leaving all of our humans to die? And it's just like that conversation didn't happen. So like in a good, positive free speech environment, the malicious actors completely took it over. And I would argue they've owned it for the past half decade. And none of the like instead of a marketplace of ideas, I feel like I'm in a dungeon of just horrible cells with everybody having their own
It
conversations.
is
And I'm like,
very
there's
dark in there, so.
yeah. So I guess like, yeah, that's kind of my so all the pushback I'm giving you, I definitely agree spiritually and foundationally with a lot of the values you're saying, but I feel like in practice, so many of these have been hijacked lately by bad actors that it's like, Jesus, I don't know what the path forward is, I guess. Yeah, it feels very gloomy sometimes when I look at it.
Yeah, there has been, understandably, a lot of people who I think have been really suspicious of, people talking about free speech because they have seen a lot of politicians, a lot of public figures, a lot of media figures, talk about free speech all the time, and then it turns out they meant very little of it, and they meant their own speech, and then they were very, very eager to cheer it on when someone they didn't like was censored. That's kind of a tale as old as time to a certain extent. But I understand why people feel that degree of suspicion and exhaustion, and I get it. The only, the best answer I can tell them is that, people like me, my colleagues at FIRE, the many other, good free speech advocates I know who are actually principled, who do genuinely care about this, who do want to find ways to help people speak freely, not because of some, secret ploy to, poison the world, but because, we believe that people should be able to express themselves, and be themselves, and that we can have a better free world that way. We want more people like that to join our ranks. We want more people talking about it. I think it's a real shame that some people shy away from the concept of free speech because they think, you're only going to talk about it if, you know, you're being insincere, if you have an ulterior motive. So what I want to see is more people talk about it, more people engage in it, because, you know, it's really a shame for people to abandon something that is so central and vital to society because bad actors use it. So I want to see more good actors, you know, engage in the conversation. I don't want to see people ceding ground because that will go nowhere good. I see no good future with people ceding the concept of free speech and these issues to bad actors. You know, if anything, if you feel like bad actors are taking over it, we have more incentive to have people who are engaging in good faith on it jump in.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. Okay. Do you have for social media where people can find you, if you were to link a particular place where you want people to look for you at?
Yeah, I'm on X. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on most of the major platforms.
And then
for now, it, no, I'm kidding. Okay. it's SARAHEMCLAUGH. That's my handle in most places.
Gotcha.
Believe it or not, there's a lot of Sarah McLaughlins, and it's difficult to get my name as a handle. Who would have known?
Yeah, I heard everybody was looking forward to the singer joining us today. So unfortunately,
there will be no performances.
Yeah. Okay, well, cool. Well, hey, listen, I really appreciate the conversation. If anything more particular comes up about this, you want to chat about the future, feel free to shoot me an email. And yeah, thanks a lot. I really appreciate having you on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And if people have follow-ups, reach out. Love to talk more.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Yep. Bye.